Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Hooton, Judge Werke, Judge Kopaki, the Honorable Carol Hooton presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are in beautiful downtown Bemidji, and we are here on the case of the State of Minnesota versus James Warren Northrup. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please introduce yourself when you come to the podium and let us know who you are and who you represent. Thank you. You may proceed at this time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Joe Plummer. My co-counsel is Frank Peeble. Mr. James Northrup is seated right in the second row. Many of our supporters are here. This is a very important case for our Anishinaabe people.
Let me just ask you a question to start with procedural. Previously, this court suggested that the trial court needed to make some findings of fact on treaties. And you listed a number of treaties in your brief. I can't seem to find very many findings of facts in the trial so far. No. So are we in any position, and we said in that order that it's hard for us to engage in a review without the findings. My question is, are we in any better position today than we were the last time this matter came before us?
Well, Your Honor,
on that subject,
I would say that because you're a reviewing court, you're going to apply the law de novo. The treaties are part of the law, and I believe that.
But our statement was that we needed to know who signed which treaties. We needed to know what the tribe's understanding was when they signed the treaty. And most particularly, as to the rights they were receiving, we don't have any of those findings. But we do have the arguments of both sides as to what the treaty says, and they don't always agree. So are we supposed to pick from these arguments? Are we supposed to go back and look at these treaties and decide for ourselves? Which is sounds like we may be finding the fact then, instead of the trial court. Help me with this.
Well, Your Honor, but respectfully, this is not an easy area of the law. That was the point we tried to make to the trial court. This case has been going on for 4 years now.
And we're sympathetic to that. We wish we could move the ball further, but you know, I think what you're trying to tell us about the treaties or the law, and we can look at these documents, is to take judicial notice of them. But where are they in our record? And that's where we feel we are at a loss in terms of moving forward.
Where are the treaties, Your Honor?
In the record before
us. They're all provided. They're all part of the record below. Every one of the 44 treaties that impact Ojibwe territory.
So are you suggesting that we go over every one of those 44 treaties to find the code to figure out this question that we previously asked, who signed them, what did they believe when they signed them, what did they understand about their retained rights?
Yeah, I think that's what we're asking you to do.
Is that what the trial court is supposed to do?
Well, Your Honor,
suggested that at least.
Yeah, we went before the trial court several times. This is the order that you have is what we got.
Well, can I just, let's just get to something as basic as whether your client, I think it's undisputed, he's enrolled as a member of the Fond du Lac Band.
Correct.
But the finding of the court was there's no support in the record finding the Fond du Lac Band was a member of the Chippewa of the Mississippi. Is that
fine? It's not disputed.
That's not disputed, so.
Right.
But I'm looking at at least one of the treaties was signed by the Chippewa of Lake Superior and Mississippi.
Right.
And then they list a number of the specific bands.
Correct.
Was he a member of the Lake Superior?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Superior Band was a predecessor to Fond du Lac, Grand Portage.
Okay. All right. So that clarifies that. So in to the extent that the judge found that he is not a member of the Chippewa of Mississippi, that really doesn't matter if he was a member of the Lake Superior?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, all right.
And your focus, much of your focus is that the treaties involve Lake Superior.
Well, what are you...
Some, the band itself, on the Black Band, but some are Lake Superior.
Correct.
So that's just a matter of timing, when it occurred?
No. The Lake Superior Chippewa and the Chippewa of the Mississippi were both parties to the 1854 and 55 treaty. Additionally, they were each parties to the 1825, which starts the groundwork for this Minnesota territory. And the 1825 treaty made clear that everything that the tribes had was, they were still invested with. It was solely a peace treaty between primarily the Ojibwe and the Sioux people.
I still have another procedural item. Attached to the respondent's brief is an addendum that lists a lot of the treaties that you're describing in your brief.
Yeah, I saw that.
And some of it has some editorial comments on those treaties. How did that get to us? Is that part of the record?
No, I'll speak frankly here, Iron. That's revisionist history. That's the editorial of the County Attorney's Association and the Minnesota Attorney General's Office.
So, but this was never a part of the record, this addendum?
No, this was not part of the record.
I'm not allowed to speak during your audit argument, sorry.
That is correct. This is your time to speak, and I don't want to waste your time. We'll ask him about that.
Sure.
All right, so if you, you know, and I want to tell you, I did go through and do kind of a chart of all these treaties. If you would lead us through your position on why these rights were retained by your client,
okay,
and which treaties we should be looking at.
If I could amend that request as well.
Yeah.
I would like to know which is the earliest treaty that you reference that would have been involved in establishing the rights that you claim for Fond du Lac.
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't a matter of the earlier treaties, like 1795 Treaty of Greenville and the 1825 establishing any rights. The United States was very young at that time. They were a weak nation. And the purposes for those early treaties, they were peace treaties between the different tribal nations. And the one that starts at our area, like I mentioned, was 1825, Treaty of Prairie du Chien. Prairie du Chien essentially established a dividing line between the Ojibwe and the Sioux people. And it persists today, and it's essentially on your people.
So the Sioux is to the south and...
Correct. Yeah. Okay.
And Fond du Lac was a signatory to that.
Lake Superior Chippewa.
And that treaty did describe these reservation of rights.
Yes.
And that, interesting, that's the treaty that created, that established it as a, I have a hard time.
Yeah, I know it's hard to wrap your head around your
own. No, not that. Yeah. It's, as opposed to Aboriginal rights, it was rights created by this treaty.
Not created.
Or recognized.
Yeah,
okay.
That's a better word.
Well, as I understand it, all the U.S. did in that treaty was intercede to get peace between the warring tribes,
yes.
Correct? And as I understand it, at least from the summary, and maybe you can tell me where it's wrong, the tribes agreed not to hunt on the other tribe's land without permission. Isn't that a fair statement?
Yeah.
And there's also, is there a statement in that treaty that the hunting and fishing rights are extinguished with the title to land provided to others?
No.
Okay, no. So that's not true?
No.
Okay, because that I got out of the summary.
Right.
All right. And that it only pertained to rights of occupancy, is that not true either?
Your Honor, here's what's critical. The Mille Lacs case by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999 is a game changer. The Mille Lacs case described the Indian canons of construction that need to be applied in order to interpret whether or not usufructuary gathering rights were abrogated. The analysis that the Mille Lacs court embarked upon was way different than any of the cases that had precedential value in Minnesota up to that point. What I'm talking about is the Clark decision, the Alexander decision from White Earth, Minnesota versus United States, the Red Lake decision, and also the Kayser decision that's represented. That was a state Supreme Court case from 1980. All four of the cases I just mentioned were focused all around 1979 and 1980, and the thinking at that time was that the language of the treaty, which said all right, title, and interest to the land.
1825 treaty.
No, I'm talking about the later ones, Your Honor.
Okay.
The 1825, I need to make this point because of my time to run out, I'm not going to be able to say it. And that's what's critical to this case.
No, and you really, I think you nailed that in your briefing. So okay. We understand that the Mille Lacs case at least provided a different, what might be a different way of interpreting these treaties.
I have one question about that.
No. Yes, sir.
That referenced the abrogation of the rights. How about the recognition of the rights?
Well, Your Honor, you have to put yourself in the position of an Indian person. And if we're looking at the 1854 and 1855 treaties now, we're talking over 160 years ago. Additionally, people didn't speak English. They relied on the people who spoke English. And so we can't take a look at the gymnastics that have developed over the past 160 years and say, this is what this means. We have to look exactly through the historical record to find out what the Indian understood at that time. And there was no language of abrogation or giving up or surrender of treaty.
Well, what treaty would you point us to that supports that these rights still exist?
I would say the most relevant ones to our area are the 1825 and the 1826, which was essentially the same treaty, but it was for the purposes of having the Ojibwe hear this firsthand because they couldn't get down to Prairie du Chien.
Is your view that these two treaties covered the whole northern area?
Correct. They do.
After the split between the Sioux and the Chippewa.
Yes, sir.
All right. Are there any other treaties that you would direct us to?
1837 is a real critical one, Your Honor.
That's the St. Peter Treaty?
Yep. Treaty of St. Peter. All of the tribes, all the Ojibwe tribes were part of that.
Okay, and that included the Fond du Lac tribe.
That included Fond du Lac.
All right. And any other treaty that you would point us to?
Yeah, 1854 and 1855, Your Honor. Those are the.
Aren't these the ones that we don't have any findings of interpretation of these canons by the trial court? I mean, was that even referenced in her decision?
That's the way we're talking about it right now. Your Honor, it's not for lack of effort, I'll tell you.
Couldn't the state representative have stipulated to at least the general understandings of some of these principles, the canons of construction, what the treaty stood for? I mean, if the district court judge didn't do it for you, could you not have presented her with stipulated evidence so she could draw a meaningful?
We stipulated facts, Your Honor. We did. We stipulated to facts that the judge considered so we didn't have to go and have a trial on whether.
Did you call the court's attention to the 1825 and 1826 treaties?
Absolutely.
But there's not a word about those in your plan.
They're foundational for our area. That's where you have to start. And I want to say one other thing before my time runs out. In order to reinforce my position that the Black case was a game changer, we need only to look 4 months back to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Herrera. The Herrera case itself said that Mille Lacs was a game changer. And the Herrera case involved a Crow tribal member who was hunting in the Bighorn National Forest for elk, which is off the reservation, in their off-reservation ceded territory. And Herrera was charged. And the reason why this went through the state court system, the state trial court and the state appellate court said that his conduct was controlled by a 100-year-old case called Racehorse, which was reaffirmed 90 years later in another case called Repsis. But because the nature of these rights needed to be reinterpreted according to the information that the Mille Lacs court provided us, that the result was all of these cases, every time we make these later arguments, you're barred because these have already, because of issue preclusion, This court, the U.S. Supreme Court, specifically said that the facts in the case, together with the reasoning of the Blacks Court, established an exception to issue preclusion. It's called the change of law exception to issue preclusion.
You know, we are a little bit ahead of schedule, so we're not cutting your time off.
Okay.
Because these are important issues, and and I'm going to extend the same offer to respondent as well. So,
okay.
So please don't feel like you've got to get done so quickly.
That's
so
great. Okay, that was a major point that I need to make. That our arguments that we raised in our brief before you were just strengthened with the Herrera case out of the U.S. Supreme Court from May of 2019, 4 months ago. They essentially say just what I said, that the Mille Lacs case was a game changer.
And how you view the treaties.
Correct.
How courts need to view the treaties.
Yes, sir.
What standards are used to decide.
Right. And specifically what those are, Your Honor? Those are the Indian canons of construction. First, treaty language must be construed as the Indians would have understood it, and the rights remain.
Let me stop you. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that I think the trial court should be telling us, what the tribe understood. We don't have that.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, in our defense, it's not for lack of effort. We provided all of the treaties, and we made our arguments based on the treaties that were introduced.
Your expert didn't cover some of the treaties that you're describing here for right. some reason why?
Well, he was an expert in the Mille Lacs case, and he essentially picked it up from where the Mille Lacs case started. We started further back just to establish that nothing was given up before that.
All right, if I understand, because I'm looking at the Washington Treaty of 1855, and again, I got some of this information from the summary that obviously you're telling me wasn't even in the record, but there's nothing in there about the reservation of these hunting and fishing rights, am I correct?
Yeah.
But you're arguing that it doesn't matter because that had already been reserved. Is that under the Mille Lacs case? That's here. Okay. So I understand that argument. But as I'm reading it, it at one point, is Gull Lake is Royce 453, is that correct?
Yes.
And those lakes were ceded in return for the establishment of a new reservation for the White Earth of Chippewa, correct?
Yeah.
And the Mille Lacs at that time were allowed to remain on their reservation. So that's my understanding of what that treaty did. Is that all correct?
Yeah. There's a couple other things, important things it did, Your Honor, and that is it established the Mille Lacs Reservation and it established the Leech Lake Reservation. And if those reservations are being established in the 1855 treaty and the treaty is silent as to usufructuary rights, what are the Natives of the Speak Ojibwe supposed to think? And this position is reinforced by the Mille Lacs Supreme Court decision and by Herrera 4 months ago.
Okay, so the Supreme Court indicated that it was transferring land, but did it specifically say anything about the hunting, fishing, gathering?
No,
the application?
It didn't say. It was silent. And so you can't.
But actually, the 1855 treaty was silent.
Yes, it was silent. 1855 was silent. And so you can't indirectly abrogate treaty rights. It needs to be clear, unequivocal.
Well, if I can summarize what you're saying here, that you're saying that the 1925 treaty, that the 1825 treaty, the 1826 treaty, recognized these rights and moved them from being inchoate rights to treaty-recognized rights, and that no treaty since then, including the 1855 treaty, abrogated those rights.
Correct. And the 1837 treaty, Your Honor, further reinforced those rights.
In 1855 transferred land, but then anything else.
Correct. They're land cession treaties. So was the 1837.
And this is how you summarize the case before the trial court as well?
Yeah. Now, and
it's complicated.
I'm confused about finding number 25 of the judge's order, and that seems to be additional findings on a compromise settlement. It's finding, I'm sorry, I said 25. It's actually 22. Finding 22. And I assume she's saying, I guess I'm a little confused on this. Was there evidence in the record then of this compromise settlement? And what is the purpose of this compromise settlement? Did it include these rights, I guess?
Well, that's the state's position, Your Honor. It's not our position. And this docket number was in the Claims Commission docket. It's from 1965. Was in the record. It should be in the record.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what is the effect of that settlement?
It was a payment for land.
All right. But it says that they're asserting that they're forever barred from asserting any other and all or any such claims or demands in any future action.
And this was interpreted by the Indians to mean pertaining to land cessions. This whole docket, 18B and 18N, was focused on land cessions, and there were other things too. We just settled one of them probably 10 years ago, Nelson Act settlement, and that one was for timber. You know, so all these docket numbers before the Indian Claims Commission were for where the tribes were shorted, you know, because of resources.
And you're representing that the settlement had nothing to do with the rights that were recognized by prior treaties.
Right. Off-reservation gathering rights, which is critical to this case.
So as I read the court's order, the court basically decided this case on the basis that your client was not a member of any of the signatory parties of these treaties. Is that, that's how I read it.
Right, what you're saying, Your Honor, what the trial court judge is saying, Judge Osted, she's saying that the Fond du Lac Band is restricted to the 1854 treaty area, and as soon as they cross over the line in between 1854 and 1855, that they lose all gathering rights. We say, show us where that was ever given up. We see in the 1854 and 1855 treaties, the land cession treaties, that those lands were ceded. But the treaty interpreters and the language that we have, some of which is in the affidavit, Your Honor, that our expert provided, shows that the Ojibwe people, chiefly Flatmouth from Leech Lake, said, we understand what you want. You want the lands. You can have the lands because we have a lot of land. But what we want is the fish from the waters and the sugar from the trees, meaning, you know, gathering rights. Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thanks.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Before you get started, can you tell us about that summary to your...
Well, first off, the Attorney General's office had no part in this litigation.
You need to introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Don Ryan, Cohen County Attorney, on behalf of the respondent. I apologize. I haven't been in the court case a while. First off, in regards to the outline, if you will, of the summary of all the treaties, I did that myself. And what that is accumulation of reading of the treaties, and providing the language that dealt with the issue which we thought we were litigating, which was the existence of
interpretation or your opinion as to what these treaties said they meant?
Give me one more moment and I'll clarify that. Otherwise, I'll come back to your question if that's acceptable. So I read the treaty, and we thought we were litigating the existence or non-existence of usurpatory rights In other words, treaty made rights in 1855 ceded territory to hunt, fish, and gather off of reservation grounds. And so when I went through all the treaties, and we did stipulate to the record on all of the treaties, I think I might have missed one, and Joan Frank supplemented the record and gave it to us.
Well, you got it. Go ahead.
I was looking at just hunting and fishing and gathering and how that was dealt with in prior treaties leading all the way up to and post the 1855 treaty, because you've got some progeny of the 55 treaty as they continue to negotiate. The Gold Lake Reservation was ceded back for more land up north, right? So then once I read all the treaties, I went through and tried to find all the case law that I could find by courts. So everything I say in the summary that I provided to the court, and I did give that in my omnibus brief to the district court as well, all come out of prior judicial determinations, whether they're findings, conclusions of laws, or actual holdings. In the cases I cite, if you go back and read through all of them, and I'll just warn you, it stacks about this high.
So this was submitted to the district court?
As part of my omnibus brief, it was. Okay. It wasn't part of the factual record, it was part of my argument.
Okay, but this is all your assessment of what these treaties say. Am I correct?
And it's not my assessment. I would be qualified to make those assessments. It's prior judicial findings and determinations that I quoted and provided cites to. I did not opine at all. They are actual judicial determinations.
Is it fair to say that these judicial determinations were made without the benefit of the recent Mille Lacs case that describes how courts are to review?
So the Mille Lacs case is a red herring in regards to what we're talking about here.
Instead of describing it as a red herring, I'd like you to respond to my question.
Okay.
It was a decision that they made, that these courts made over many years, that didn't have the benefit of the Mille Lacs case description as to how you're supposed to view these treaties.
I can't tell you if every one of those cases were decided before the Mille Lacs case, and the Mille Lacs case is strung all over a span of years. I can tell you that many of them are. I can't tell you that they all are. Just to answer your question.
All right. How would you I mean, is the Mille Lacs case binding upon us
No.
in interpreting and in how we interpret these treaties, though? Because basically, as what I hear you saying, based on your summary, now that I know it's your interpretation, is that if you don't say something about the rights, a reservation of the rights, they're given up. Is that a fair statement on what you're saying?
I believe that to be the law in this
Okay, case. But the Mille Lacs case said, and you know, that you've got to view it and how the Native Americans viewed it.
I can explain my position.
Okay.
So you have Aboriginal rights, which are part and parcel of Aboriginal title. Then you have usufructuary rights, which by analogy are like easement over a parcel of land that you sell to someone, but you have an ingress egress easement. You get to use someone else's land for that purpose. Maybe a bad analogy, but it's the kind of analogy that I've heard you. The 1855 treaty, when it was ceded, no usufructuary or treaty made right fish, hunt, and gather existed. It was Aboriginal title and has been found by the Minnesota Supreme Court and federal courts prior to today's proceedings. That's all cited in my
brief. The representation here today is that there are a number of treaties that recognize these gathering rights.
And I submit, if you read my brief and the cases in there, that appellant is wrong, that the creation of treaty rights or usufructuary rights only applies to this territory ceded within that territory. It doesn't create a vast.
Doesn't surprise you that you have two different views on that.
Well, there's three lawyers who probably have four opinions, right?
But this is
one
the problem.
One opinion that we don't have is the trial court's finding on these treaties.
And the and I understand all these exhibits came in, it was stipulated. I get that, but what I'm getting at is there's no stipulation as to what those documents meant. And that's what I'm trying to say, is that the court's supposed to take those documents and make a determination so we have something to review.
All I can say procedurally, Judge Working, is that Judge, and I'm not throwing anybody in the bus, Judge DeMay was the judge who certified the question to the Court of Appeals. You sent it back with direction. She then, appellant then sought to have her recused. She recused herself. Judge Osted was appointed. That record had all been done. We didn't do anything more than basically, I believe, brief it at that point in time. And Judge Asta didn't rule on the 1855 ceded territory issue at all. She went on a different tangent, sua sponte, and again, I'm throwing nobody under the bus. Sua sponte to what gets us here today.
Well, let's talk about the judge's order. Because as I view the judge's order, she's basically saying the tribes have the right. I mean, as I read the order, she said they do have the continuing rights to fish on Gull Lake. So, but then she says, but this, that Mr. Northrup is a member of the Fond du Lac band, and the Fond du Lac band wasn't a signatory to any of these treaties. So it seems to me she's basing the decision solely on that basis. In fact, she indicates it may be a different situation with Mr. Thompson.
Which side, which part of that question would you like me to answer?
Well, I guess, I mean, what, as I look at these treaties, and maybe you can help me here, and I've got most of this information from your summary, the Fond du Lac tribe is part of the Lake Superior tribe.
Yeah, everyone's in agreement on that.
And the Lake Superior was a signatory to many of these treaties, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what?
1854 and previous.
So how can you say that because he wasn't part of the signatory tribe that signed? I mean, because it seemed like Lake Superior involved a number of tribes, of mm-hmm. smaller tribes. How can you say that he is not entitled to relief because he wasn't a member of any signatory group?
Two reasons on that specific issue. The Minnesota Supreme Court, the federal courts, and the United States Supreme Court, on cases of this, I did my brief, and I don't want to regurgitate them all here, specifically say, if you are an Indian, Native American, and you wish to exercise rights under a treaty, you have to be a member of a tribe, or in this instance possibly a band, that was signatory to that treaty. It's one of the first things I said right in my brief. That is black letter law in the state of Minnesota, and in the United States of America, and to determine otherwise would undo all the litigation that's been done up to this point in time, and Mille Lacs does not address that issue. It has not, it is completely silent on that issue. What Mille Lacs held, if you read the case all the way through, and there's a lot of good history in there, you see I cite the same case they do many, many times, more for the factual findings than anything else. Because those are some experts on each side. We didn't have an expert in this case, and so as a smaller county, we, again, focused just on the 1855. But Mille Lacs' case said, succinctly, is that in 1837, they entered into a treaty, they fought and successfully reserved usufructuary rights in the 1837 ceded territory. And then later in 1855, an unrelated piece of property, if you will, it's not reasonable to think, without even having a discussion, they would give up previous treaty-established rights. 1855, as recognized by the Minnesota Supreme Court, was still aboriginal property prior to the signing of aboriginal land and held as aboriginal title, as cited in my brief, prior to the entering of the 1855 treaty. Hence, aboriginal rights are mere rights of possession, and when they surrender that without reserving usufructuary rights, they're gone.
Counsel suggests that I misnamed it, that there were treaties that recognized rights, so beyond the Unicode rights, and they became then these gathering rights.
If one exists.
By reason of those sort of treaties.
If one exists, I have not read it. I have not seen it.
Counsel,
and the counsel cites the no case
that says the 1825, 1826, and 1837.
And none of those treaties to fuck realized in the 1855 ceded territory. And there's not one case that I have found, and I am not an Indian law expert, that says that usufructuary rights are created outside of the ceded territory associated
That's
with.
That's my question.
They are not.
Can they be recognized by the United States without it being part of a ceded territory treaty?
In dealing with aboriginal title, when the United States were recognizing or would say that that is Indian country or that they maintain right on that land, they're talking aboriginal right. what the United States can and can't do, I'm not qualified to speak to, nor am I authorized by the United States to say what they can and can or will or will not do.
Well, can I, because it seems like we have two things going on in this case, mm-hmm. and one is whether, I mean, it looked like those early treaties, they there was a reservation of rights for hunting and fishing and gathering in the early treaties, but then the judge then, with reference to the 1864 treaty, notes that as to the reservation at Gull Lake, that there were rights that they maintained because the U.S. was supposed to make some payments and they didn't do so and they still haven't.
Well, specifically,
and so that seems to be a whole different theory that the judge was going under than just the rights.
And that would have dealt only with the Gull Lake Reservation because that was the only issue before the court. And if I were an Indian law expert, I would have known of the case on United States v. Minnesota 46 S Supreme Court 298, a 2012 case in which the United States Supreme Court in its dicta on page.
Okay, but are you saying the judge was wrong on that?
In all due respect, the judge was wrong.
But you didn't cross appeal. So, I mean, we're reviewing court and no one's said any of these findings were clearly erroneous.
And I decided to dismiss the case against Mr. Thompson. Couple of different reasons. One, we didn't have an expert. Hindsight, we should have had an expert. Two, we allowed his affidavit to come in on cross-examining. He's a bad lawyer on my part. I'm going to have to own that. We thought we were litigating what I believe was already a determination made by state and federal courts in regards to 1855 ceded territory. You look at White Earth in Minnesota, that court said the 1855 ceded territory, there were no usufructory rights, to my belief, under the 1855 ceded territory, but those were reestablished on the White Earth Reservation within reservation boundaries.
Well,
I was going by the law at the time.
Well, let me just, because we're reviewing court, so we only review what is brought before us. So we have before us a number of findings and conclusions of law that have really not been opposed by the state here. I guess that puts us in a very odd position because I assume, based on the arguments, that there is arguments that the Fond du Lac band was a signatory party. So they are contesting that finding, but the other findings and conclusions are not being contested here. So are we really limited to whether he was or was not a member of a signatory party based on the nature of this?
I would submit as a threshold question, which is what would have started. That was my plan. Of course, that never works out that way.
Okay.
The threshold question is, does the appellant have any rights, any there be, under the 1855 the 1855 treaty and its project?
So you're just saying we don't need to decide if they had rights, we're just deciding if he was a member?
Yeah, so if he, in order to determine if someone properly exercised rights under a treaty, they have to have standing to exercise their rights under the treaty, correct? It has to present a right issue to you. I submit that's not here today. So it's a threshold question. Did Mr. Northrup have rights under the 1855 ceded territory, if any of they would be? He's not a signatory tribe. If you look at page 3 of my brief, I outline that, and basically it's issue based conclusion. You know, go no further than to affirm the district court in the finding that he had no rights even if they existed. I would also point you to the 1854 treaty. So in the 1854 treaty, the Chippewa of Lake Superior, it's in Article 1, the Chippewa of Lake Superior, and this is in my brief as well, ceded all right interest of whatever nature to the Chippewa of the Mississippi. And the Chippewa of the Mississippi signed off on that and ceded everything to the Chippewa of Lake Superior, and a north-south line was drawn in regards to who had what rights. Lake Superior got everything east of the line. Mississippi got everything west of the line. 1855 ceded territory is completely west of that line. And in exchange for that, if you read the treaty, which is part of the record, Fond du Lac got all the money and everything associated with the cession of those lands. And in 1855, when the Mississippi Band was a signatory to thing, the use of property rights are specifically spelled out in that. If you would go with what the appellants are arguing, then the Mississippi Band should get to go net fish on Lake Superior too. Basically, they're saying, starting with 1825 going forward, any treaty that was existed, be it anybody that has a signature, the ability to do anything, and had absolute rights of every one of the other tribes that gave up stuff in ceded territories, even if that wasn't where they were at, and they were over in the 1855 area. But once they, even if they're right, and I assume that they're not, because that would undo all the law of the land, I mean, any Native American basically could hook that to the farthest end, gets you exercise use of property rights in the whole Northwest Territory. I submit that's not the law of the land. In any event, in regards to the Fond du Lac Band, once they entered into the 1854 treaty, they gave up all right interest. And so I'll read the language to you. The Chippewas of the Mississippi hereby consent and agree to the foregoing session, and that was the description. Consent for the whole amount of consideration for the country ceded above shall be paid to the Chippewas of Lake Superior. And in consideration thereof, the Chippewas of Lake Superior hereby relinquish to the Chippewas of the Mississippi all of their interest and claim to the lands heretofore owned by them in common, lying west of the above boundary line. This particular language was interpreted by the federal court, and it's in my brief, but it's at 315 F. 2nd 906, Minnesota Chippewa Tribe v. the United States. And this comes out of the ICC cases, where the Indian Claims Commission had excluded two small parcels of land within the 1855 ceded territory, saying that the Mississippi Chippewa had not demonstrated ownership. And if you go to that particular case, page 266, it outlines for you the establishment and explains in the 1854 ceded territory that the Chippewa were divided into the Chippewas of Lake Superior and the Chippewas of the Mississippi, and they were treated as separate parties. And then basically, I won't read the whole thing.
Well, in this line, I assume the Lake Superior, were they on the part of the line that includes Gull Lake?
They were not. They were east of that line.
They were east of the line.
So all of the land that we're dealing with here, Gull Lake, you know, the whole 1855 ceded territory is west of the line that the Lake, the Superior Chippewa gave up all title, interest, and any ability to do anything. That's just positive. It's no different than any other kind of trading situation. In their, in appellant's brief at, what was that?
And that's why the judge decided that the that Mr. Thompson may have a defense here, and
correct,
Mr. Northrup.
And again, we decided to live another day in regards to this, Mr. Thompson, and establish a better record when trying to bring these confusing issues up. And this is my one and only Indian law case, so I mean, we're doing the best we could do. So I submit that that's the threshold question, and the court should be affirmed on that point. And then that's the end of the
case. It's dispositive, we're done, we
just
don't
positive, we're done, we go home for the day, and we let the next case, wherever that would go, that comes up to the appellate level, deal with all these other complicated issues.
Do a better job on establishing a better record for us.
So, in preparation, the Supreme Court case I was talking about, the Swampland case I studied to cite to you, I learned of that Tuesday by talking to some people who know more about this area of the law than I had. Had I known that back then, I probably would have either filed with the court, asked for reconsideration, or whatever. But again, you know, everyone's doing the best they can do with what they particularly have. But in that case, the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe v. the U.S., the U.S., where the court goes through and starts talking about how by 1855, the Mississippi Chippewa had established ownership and residency of everything west of that 1854 ceded territory line. It says nothing, absolutely nothing, about the Chippewa off of Lake Superior, and that's because they'd already given up any interest they had to that. And this is coming out of the Indian Claims Commission's courts. It's the federal courts interpreting them, overturning them, and sending them back. This all predates the settlement that you referenced. And so, again, basically, I think that that's the dispositive answer, and it's the end of it. In my brief, I do point out certain things about the
LCC. You know, you're way over your time. And then
Never let a lawyer say that you keep going.
No, and I do want to
thank you.
So I did give you quite a bit of latitude there. And I will also allow.
Okay, Mr. Beaver's going to do the rebuttal.
Oh, okay.
Good afternoon, my name is Frank Bebo.
Bebo, can you comment on respondents' recent argument that what happened between the Mississippi Band and the Lake Superior Band is positive?
That question, I just want to say it's vague a little bit, but let me just tell you how I understand things. That might help you get to that same place. I think it's dispositive, but I think it's dispositive for a different reason. And it's because the Mille Lacs decision in 1999, I think, already has addressed these issues. Two things happened with the Mille Lacs decision. One of them was they talked about whether or not Fond du Lac could exercise rights in the 37 because they hadn't used or occupied the territory. And the Mille Lacs decision said they could. And if you look at the exhibit that has all the 1847 bands, you'll see that Fond du Lac was at the 25, the 26, the 37, and the 42. And so in 42, what they did was they had tried to do what was suggested by the Crow Wing attorney to keep us separate. They didn't understand we were all one people, the Anishinaabe people were all one. And they called us Lake Superior because of that divide, and then Mississippi because of that divide. But they wanted to treat us all equally. So in the 42 treaty, they talk about all of our rights being held in common amongst ourselves, and all the lands that have been ceded already and yet to be ceded are held in common. When they got to the end of Minnesota in the 54 and 55, those treaties are less than 3 months apart. And so they were trying to balance out the money for the people, because typically Lake Superior was 1/3, you'll see those numbers, and Mississippi was 2/3. And so the trick of the law by the drafters was that they relinquished all right, title, and interest west of the 54. But if you look at the Black decision, that says that doesn't mean anything. You're just relinquishing land. And so the Chippewa of Lake Superior, until the 54 treaty, had every right to hunt in the 55 and beyond. They just relinquished the land so that the Mississippi could get full payment.
So what you're saying is we can say he was a member of a signatory to the treaty, and it's dispositive then?
They would be a signatory to the 25, 26, 37, 42, right into the 54.
Can you go slower?
I'm sorry.
Because I'm marking them as
sure.
You see them, so.
They weren't a signatory to the 55 because
we're talking about Fond du Lac.
Right. Because the United States separated those two land purchases by the continental divides. So the Lake Superior Band ended up getting about 7 million acres, and that was 1/3 of the Chippewa. And then the Mississippi got about 11 or 12 million acres.
Where was the line?
The line, it almost follows the divide. If I had a map in front of me, I would show you it's just a little west of, or east of McGregor, going almost straight up. You see it on the maps all the time. When they say the arrowhead of Minnesota, that's almost what the 54 territory is. And so when you look at these treaties, not only the 25, but the 26 treaty in particular, that was conducted at Fond du Lac, old Fond du Lac in 1826 when it was still Michigan territory. And in there they talk about the Indians, and this is the important part, not relinquishing title to the land or jurisdiction. Because what the United States got out of the deal with us was that we weren't going to fight with the Sioux over any land purchases. That's what they got. That means a lot if you're trying to buy big chunks of land. It's hard to understand what the consideration is, but nowhere does it discuss that our rights were relinquished. And that's what the Supreme Court talked about. They looked at the 55 and said, no, they only gave up the land. So Fond du Lac in 54 only gave up the land. They still have the right in the 55 because they were landowners. That's how you have to look at this. When Crow Wing County dismissed Thompson, it became a 54 case. We had four people charged that day. Three of them were White Earth 55 members, Malak. We were all Mississippi. It got whittled down to a 54 member at the end. When the judge made that ruling, they dropped the White Earth member and left us with the Fond du Lac. So that was a decision of the court, a decision of Crow Wing. But if you look at the Malak decision, it controls on both those issues.
Well, which, and again, now, it seems to me that the judge agrees that Mr. Thompson, that he had rights to fish on the lake in whatever manner he chose to fish. But she did not decide that with reference to Mr. Northrup. So how, what treaties can you point to that where he would be part of the signatory ban that would affect his rights?
1825, 1826 are the first two. They cover from Michigan all the way over into North Dakota.
Fond du Lac is encompassed in those.
That's right.
All what you're saying.
And so if you look at that 1847 list of bans, that's from the National Archives, it gives you a better idea of what bans are. Those are addresses for the mail. Red Lake, Leech Lake, you know? These are names of lakes where we lived. That's how those names came about. It wasn't that we were separating ourselves from each other. They were trying to figure out how to deal with us at the beginning, much like Mr. Ryan was talking about, as individual territories, and they realized that wasn't going to work and it wasn't the right way because of how we looked at ourselves.
Mr. Ryan suggests that we cannot create these reserved rights by anything other than a ceding treaty. And he says 25 and 26 are not ceding treaties, and I don't know what's mother, but he's suggesting that these rights are still the, whatever rights are there, we're not gathering rights, but were aboriginal rights, that these treaties did not recognize any other rights because there was no ceding. I hope I stated this.
That's pretty close, I think.
I'd like your comment.
What I would say is you could call them aboriginal rights in 1824. In 1825, when the United States made that treaty goes to Washington, Congress looks at it, they review it, they herald it and proclaim it and say it's the law of the land. And in that treaty, the Chippewa said, you know, there's a lot of us, and before we can accept this deal, you need to come back next year and talk to more of us up at Fond du Lac. And that's what the United States did. And so you have two federally recorded federal statutes that are federal laws. And if you look at Goshnik, they talk about Congress is the only one who can abrogate those treaties. They've never abrogated those two treaties because people think land wasn't relinquished.
Well, can I just go back to the 1825 treaty? Because as I understand that, it was basically a treaty trying to keep the tribes from fighting with each other. And they drew that line, and they said basically, you can't hunt on this property unless you get permission and consent from the other tribes, and vice versa. Now, in that, this did not involve an agreement vis-a-vis the U.S. I mean, are they even applicable? I guess because it's not that the U.S. hadn't been ceded any land at that point, but would that fact change how we view this?
No, I believe the last words of the 1825 treaty says it's obligatory upon the parties. Then you find a signatory for the United States right after that. So I think that treaty is obligatory on the United States just like it is on us. And if we didn't understand what our boundary was and that we were in control of hunt, fishing, gathering before somebody came in, you weren't going to get the next deal. That's what that was.
All right, so any rights that Mr. Northrup has is under the 25 and 26 treaties, is that what you're claiming?
If you're going to look for the magic words, yes. If you're going to look at the Mille Lacs decision, where they were co-owners of the 54 and 55, what they became, northern Minnesota, north of the 37, then you see that they relinquished their title and claim to the 55, and that is not a bar to continuing to hunt, fish, and gather. So that was their land with us in what became the 55. They just relinquished the land, so we got the payment.
They relinquished, you mean Mississippi?
Fond du Lac and other bands, the 54, Lake Superior, they relinquished.
And this is the LaPointe, September 30th. And as I understand that the land east of that line was ceded to the U.S., right?
Yes. Where they hunt, fish, and gather today.
All right. And you know what?
It's been plenty of time. And
I appreciate it. And we don't usually allow more time, but these issues are complex enough and we had a number of questions, and I appreciate you both parties trying to answer our questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory period of time. Thank you.